This has been on
Blog Talk Radio.
Sorry. Okay. Good evening, everyone. This is Salita on Say Your Peace Radio Network. I know it's been a while since we've been on. It's been about a month now. I have been trying to get some of my school stuff out of the way, classes behind classes, so much stuff going on, but we are here tonight. I had to do this show because I had an opportunity to meet such a great young man who's doing great things with a situation that had happened to him, him losing his family. And we're going to let him tell you more about it. But before we get that started, I want to welcome Mr. John Gaines. And I want to welcome my sometime co-host, Mr. Brian Coleman. How are you doing, Mr. Brian Coleman?
I'm doing fine. How are you? How's everyone?
Great, great, great. Okay, you guys, tonight what I'm going to do is I'm going to kind of let Mr. Gaines tell his story, interjecting from time to time, but I want him to tell his story because I think it's very important that he's allowed to let everyone know what has happened to him in the past year, because I think this happened last year. And he needs to be able to get this story out because we have to uncover and expose what has been, in some instances, holding the African-American community behind or back, in other words. So, Mr. Gaines, I'm going to go ahead and let you get started.
Okay.
You guys be patient. Listen, I'm hoping that you get something out of this. And if possible, we're going to bring Mr. Gaines back. And if you're interested, tomorrow morning on www.1110ktcam.com. We'll have Mr. Gaines again on our local show. So we want you guys to listen in, and I'm hoping and praying you understand and learn something from this. Okay, Mr. Gaines, go ahead.
Okay. Okay. First of all, I want to say thank you to you and Mr. Coleman, Mr. Carl, for having me on your show. Also, Mr. Brother William or Mohabier should have called in, too, from the Clinton residence I told you about. But you should have called in or be on the phone. Okay, well, I want to start off again.
Go ahead. I think he's at 225.
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay,
he's
great,
on.
Great.
Well, I'm going to start off with, you know, from the beginning. On May 30th, 2012 of last year, I had a total of six family members and a family friend that were coming from church in a rural part of Louisiana, about 30 minutes outside of the city of Baton Rouge. My mother, my sister, four children, ages 5, 11, 13, and 15, and a family friend was coming from Bible study in Clinton, Louisiana, East Feliciana Parish. That night, approximately 9:30, they was hit head-on by a drunk driver by the name Brett Gastangiro. Now, initially, five people were killed initially in this crash. My mother, sister, and my sister's five-year-old son, and her 11-year-old daughter. Her two older children, the 13-year and 50-year-old, were in critical condition. What really began to bother the family initially was that this young white man that killed my family, he was released on a $256,000 property bond within hours of killing five people, critically injured two. So basically, while we were scrambling to find out what had happened and just to start the process for burial arrangements, you know, in the struggle we were in, this young man was back at home with his family. That was on May 30th. Now, as of June the 3rd, the 15-year-old nephew was taken off for life support. Now, the family was outraged as well as the public to see this man get in the back of a police car, you know, hours after killing so many people. You know, it was a public outrage as well as the family's outrage. On the 3rd of June, the 15-year-old was taken off of life support. And Mr. Gerald was then re-sentenced and booked on a sixth count of vehicle homicide. It was only then, and because of the outpour of the outrage of the community and the families calling in and speaking to the DJ and demanding something being done about it, that the judge in open court, after rebooking him, increased this amount. Now, he had been out, and he back at court, he increased the amount to $1 million. The family negated to get him out. He stayed in on that bail, but it was just we was just stunned that he was able to get out on such a small bond amount, a property bond at that. You know, being that I'm a commissioned officer, you know, and I've been in parishes like Clinton, I've seen fights warrant higher bond amounts, especially a property bond. So we was concerned about the treatment he was being given initially before we knew the details of what had happened in the case. We knew it was a form of favoritism there based on the bond amount and him getting out so early. Going on into the case, the initial proceedings of the case, well, we had a point now where we've reviewed everything. We had a funeral and we raised money for the burial, so because no one had insurance. So that was successful. I don't want to get into too many details. There's a lot of details surrounding this because in the midst of that, about day two, we was indirectly contacted by a senator, a former senator that was wanted to be a part of the case. Eventually, we had to release him because we felt there was a conflict of interest on the case because when we met him initially, on the I think it was the day we took the 15-year-old off of life support, we met with him for our initial meeting, consultation. And, you know, he had information on the young man, his, you know, where he lived, what he owned, his family information, where he, his vehicle information, and, you know, and his prior arrest history. He made a statement to the family, oh, yeah, by the way, he has political ties. So that really threw my family, especially me, because, you know, from the initial bond set amount, realizing that there was some kind of political involvement, I kind of put the two together and say, well, that kind of explains the favoritism he had getting. But what this concerned the family was we were never told who this political tie was. That night, after obtaining that information from this previous counsel, I began to do research on the information that he gave me. When I pulled up the grandfather's name, which had a question mark by it, it stated that Wikipedia popped up. So I'm like, man, it's Wikipedia. So, you know, it began to speak and give information on the grandfather. The grandfather's name is Gaston Gerald. Now, when I began to read this information off of Wikipedia, it dawned on me that, you know, he had some strong political ties because Wikipedia, if you pull it up and look up Gaston Gerald, you'll find that he was a 65 to 71 Baton Rouge City Council member, a three-term senator out of Baton Rouge. And during his second term, in the building of what they have here is the Civic Center. It used to be. It then became the Central Plex, it's now the River Center in Baton Rouge. The contractors were building the initial Civic Center that was there in 1980 fell behind on their bid to build this building. Mr. Gerald, because of his prior connections with the Baton Rouge City Council and his current senator, decided to start money from these contractors into an attempt to persuade the current council to influence them on this contract, that this contractor would probably lose. He had influential ties. When I pulled up the history on it, he had influence with the mayor, and it was a lot of things about going about and attempting to bribe this current council. This all information that you can pull up via your computers. Mr. Gerald attempted to bribe the current council and was, I think it was a whistleblower, the actual contractor, I think, contacted the FBI. And they set Mr. Gerald up where he was convicted for extortion and attempted bribery. Mr. Gerald was sentenced to 5 years in federal prison. Now, what was really puzzling was Mr. Gerald, Gaston Gerald, the grandfather, when he went, before he went to federal prison, he was in his second term, but had ran for a third term. After conviction, he obtained a third term as senator. So, and went off to federal prison. Now, when Mr. Gerald, Gaston Gerald, was in federal prison, he still received his salary from the Senate. And you can, like, mm-hmm. all this information is available. He still received his salary from the Senate. He befriended an insurance adjuster that was in for the same charges, a bribery and extortion. He was an insurance adjuster. And he, in turn, got out of federal prison. Well, Mr. Gerald put this convicted insurance adjuster on the Senate payroll as his aide for $900 a month. Mr. Gerald then himself got out after serving 2.5 years. And I think some kind of way he was eventually forced out or voted off of from the Senate. Now, Mr. Gerald has strong political ties, and we think he still wields those same ties because he also had influences with the Supreme Court. Mr. Gerald afforded the former Supreme Justice of Louisiana, Mr. Calogero's son, a scholarship to Tulane. He sponsored that for him, using an 1800 law where legislators could sponsor scholarships to Tulane University. So that was a big article in the paper as well, and you can pull that up as well. So this it really concerned me that this man had wielded so much power, and that, you know, this was his grandson that was involved. So, you know, being skeptical of it at first, saying, well, maybe this ain't it, maybe it's just something else. You know, as we go on, we brought this information, I brought it the next day to my family. I said, well, look, you know, this boy's grandfather was a former senator. Then he was convicted, and he had a lot of power. And my brother stated to me, he said, well, guess what else? He's named after his grandfather. His name is Brett Gaston Gerald. So he's like, wow. So the information we wasn't afforded initially by this counsel we had, who was a former senator himself, we went back to him with that information, you know, and he didn't even want to discuss Gaston Gerald. He wouldn't want to utter his name. So the family took the position to just sit back because we were still in shock, you know, for everything going on, not to overreact. So we laid back on that. A lot of things started happening that we were seeing that was really apparent in the case. The counsel we had, the former senator, negated to go into the media with us. You know, so we're doing a lot of media interviews. The media was saying, well, where's the attorney for the family? You know, but he was always busy, you know. So I began to do my own public relations and investigation in the case. You know, I am a commissioned officer of the state, so I'm familiar with the judicial proceedings throughout the state through my occupation. So I was familiar of the general proceedings and things of that nature and a lot of the laws and things I had to research. As we go on, you know, paying attention to these things, not wanting to discuss the political ties with us, we go on in the case. We then found out from strong sources that the DA himself was related to this young man. Now, a lot of information that came forth now as we get into the first week. By the 10th of June, we took the 13-year off life support. So Mr. Gerald was recharged again for 7 counts of vehicle homicide. Information was surfaced from strong credentialed people that the DA over the case was related to Brett Gerald. We sent Mr. Fields through the former counsel. He sent a investigator to the DA. You know, I have that information as well from the emails and stuff on that. The investigator said, well, let's just ask him if he related. You know, the investigator said in the email, during his formal meetings with the DA, he was pleasant, but today something definitely was wrong. He said what should have took a few minutes took forever because he simply asked the DA that the gang family heard rumors that he was related. The DA replied to the investigator that he didn't know if he was related to him. He then got sarcastic and smart and stated that he could be related to the DA. I mean, to the investigator. He and then he stated he can be related to our former counsel. He then stated in his closing statement is, if I am related, I still would not recuse myself from this case. So, you know, from the former counsel in the case, it was like, wow, maybe it's true. But no one pursued that, you know.
You're saying no one came in on to even challenge that at all.
It challenged that at all. We were being told by, I'm going to say the name of it, even though I haven't brought the information out. The former counsel we had was the former Senator Cleo Fields. He was the one that took the money from Edwin Edwards. Now, he got involved with the case, and we removed him from the case. That was our former counsel, this former black senator, okay? So that's who he was. So
okay.
We're looking at political ties, you know, from this young man, and he was a senator, and Mr. Fields was a senator. So instead of me overreacting with it, I decided to just keep this in my memory bank and look at the case with this information to how the case would go forward. But like I say, it was clearly evident that Mr. Fields was not trying to pursue the case, per se, the criminal side. And however, there is a DA in that. But now that we have the information of allegations of possible relation with even him, now, let me interject this. This young man had, in the media, was found out through the media that he had three prior DWI arrests, but yet he only had one conviction, and I'm going to go through them as follows. In 04, he was stopped on a rural highway, four-way intersection on a highway, behind another vehicle in traffic, car running, foot on brake, in gear, tail lights on. Dead asleep. The arresting officer approached him at the car, and it took him a minute to wake him up. When he woke him up, his eyes were bloodshot red, speech was slurred. He was arrested for DWI, first offense. Mr. Jarrett refused breathalyzer. Now, in Louisiana, we have what they call implied consent law, but yet he was allowed to go through a diversion program and to have that expunged off his record. But, however, that's supposed to stay on his record and for at least 5 years for expungement, and he could have it off if he, you know, abided by those terms. However, in 07, this case didn't even make on his records, even though it was clearly written up by the state troopers. This happened in Tangipahoa Parish. Mr. Gerald, in the wee hours of the night, was going down the highway to a T intersection where he could turn left or right. He continued through the T intersection, straight through, didn't stop, went across a ditch, 25 feet across the ditch after he crossed the ditch, and hit a guardrail around a train track. Mr. Gerald abandoned his truck. And it's strange in the report because it states that Mr. Gerald was summoned back to the scene. It seemed that from the report there was a passenger in the vehicle that it made no mention of, but it evident from the reports, the documents, there was a passenger in the vehicle. So the arresting officer stated that he contacted Mr. Gerald through a number he obtained, and the number was in the report. He contacted the number, and one of the family members answered and said he didn't live there. And then Mr. Gerald, he then hung up and called, according to the report, called the same number again, a identical number in the report. This time, 5 minutes later, Mr. Gerald answers. He told him why did he leave the scene and was summoned back. Now, it took him an hour to get back to the scene. No charges were filed on Mr. Gerald. The police report was written up, and that was the end of that. Okay, in 08, on the same highway, Highway 67, the tragedy of my family and friend that was in the car, he had an identical accident. And I wouldn't call it an accident. It was a identical incident. Mr. Gerald, on 67, veered into another lady's lane of travel. And fortunately, she was able to cross the center line back into his lane. He still hit her on the passenger side of the car, continued on down the highway, and ran several other people off the road, according to the statements from the state trooper and the eyewitnesses in this case. When the state trooper finally pulled him over from all the calls they were getting in, Mr. Gerald, you know, was identified by the state trooper the same way, excuse me, the same way he was in the 04 incident. I had bloodshot red. They said he had to lean on the car based on the observation from the officer. You know, he smelled alcohol. Mr. Jill refused his breathalyzer. The same DA who we allege is related to him reduced the charges to reckless driving. And Mr. Jill was released in that. That's the 08 incident on the same highway with the same DA. The 2010 incident was in Denham Springs where Mr. Gerald ran a police officer off the road. He veered into his lane and ran him off the road. Mr. Gerald then was booked for his first offense, DWI, in 2010. And he was eligible for, I think, Article 893 or 4 for expungement because of the way they scripted his prior arrest. So in 2012, he ultimately, on May 30th, killed seven people. And this was the end result. So from all this information that the family compiled, we not only feel that Mr. Gerald is at fault, but we feel the state is also at fault for enabling Mr. Gerald to continually be on the road. Now, being that we've gone through this case, and I'm going to describe all the events this far, but I want to give everyone a kind of description of what's surrounding the dynamics of this case. Initially, when we got a copy of the police report, let me retract a minute. We went to the funeral. Okay, we had a musical with this former senator, which he assisted with, and assisted with the funeral. Beautiful funeral. Everything was great. He told me the day before the funeral, he said, "Mr. Gaines, you know, we're going to have the media come to the funeral. I'm going to have them in the balcony away from the family." You know, I didn't see any problem with that. So the family agreed to the media being at the funeral. When we made it out to the church that morning, that we had the musical on the 7th of June, which mean in turn we had the funeral on the 8th, the following day. It was successful. We raised the money to bury the family. Very strong support from the community, and we thank them so much to assist us in that. On the day of the funeral, after we got out of our family cars to enter this church, now, the capacity of this church holds 6,000. There was very well over 6,000 people at this church. It was a very huge funeral. When we got to the front door of the church, we noted this former senator, Cleo Fields, holding the door, but he had two gentlemen standing outside the door with him. When we got to him, we realized who they were. It was the DA that was over the 08 and our case, and it was the DA of East Baton Rouge Parish at the front door. Now, you know, I found it odd that they would be there meeting us at the front door at the funeral. You know, it didn't seem like it was, you know, a decent time for to meet them. But, however, they took that opportunity. What I found strange was there was no media there. But,
Mr. Gaines, not to cut you off, but let me ask you this. For those people who may have just tuned in, and then you can go right back to it. Why don't you tell them what state, what parish in the city that this is taking place in? Because some people have just come on and they're not really sure what where we at on it.
Okay. Well, basically, it happened in East Feliciana Parish, and that's called Clinton, Louisiana. I think it's the 20th JDC. The judge, William G. Carmichael, and the DA is District Attorney Samuel DeQuilla of the 20th JDC.
And
so
for those
who
don't know it, they, East Feliciana Parish is the same as another state would call a county. Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, exactly. It is, you know, in Louisiana we do have parishes.
Right.
Because of our roots with the French and the Spanish. But the thing of it is, when we got there, you know, Mr. Fields was holding the door, and Mr. DeQuilla and Mr. Hiller Moore, the DA for Baton Rouge, were at the front door. So Mr. Fields introduced these two DAs to basically me and my father. Now, my whole family's here, but he stated that this is Reverend Gaines, which my father's a reverend, and he is the same name as mine, but he's a senior, John Thomas Gaines Sr., and I'm John Jr. He said, "This is Reverend Gaines," and, "Oh, yeah, this is John Gaines Jr." You know, I took that as like, well, and what about the rest of my family? And why an emphasis on me? But I knew clearly what it was. He clearly see that I was going to be a problem in the case, and that's how I took it. So I'm looking to find out why these two DAs at the front door of the church. And if they're clearly...
Let me add this, and I don't want to continue to cut you off, but people need to also know some of the history, and I don't personally know him, but this is the same Senator Cleo Field that ran for governor of Louisiana that could not get the endorsement of the current Senator Mary Landrieu, which is a white woman, but he is black, but then he turned around after being slapped in the face like that, and he endorsed her when she ran. So I want them kind of get a gist of the history and what kind of person they're dealing with. But go ahead.
Exactly. And also, to add.
Hold up. Mr. Ryan, let me break it down to you. You got to really listen to what he's saying about Mr. Fields, okay? Listen to what he's saying about Mr. Fields, okay? Go ahead.
Okay. Now, the thing of it with Mr. Fields, also to add to Mr. Fields, and Mr. Fields is the same senator that took the money for Governor Edwin Edwards, okay? He's the one that had the money that was given to him in a bag, and he was caught on camera taking the money from the former convicted governor of the state, Edwin Edwards. That is the same Mr. Fields, you know? So the thing of it is, I thought about that initially, but initially we knew that it was just a DWI case. So we figured that, you know, we can get, being that there was no one there burial, we'll get involved with Mr. Fields. So as all this starts to come out and we find out these things are happening, I notice Mr. Fields is not in the media with us. We realize that we find out that Mr. Gerald had political ties, yet we were not told who those ties were. We got the DA from Clinton, East Feliciana Parish, and the DA from East Baton Rouge at the front door of the funeral. I clearly seen a script there, and I was able to, even being in shock, but numb at the time, be able to still see that there was something funny going on. Like I say, I work in the legal field with offenders daily. I'm very familiar with the habits of offenders and nature of people, because that's the line of work I'm in. And I could clearly see a con coming. I could see that we were trying to be washed up, you know? It's like, well, let's come up with a burial, let's have a musical form, and then we're going to fix this. So as I watched it go on, I kept that information in my head. I began to continue to investigate. We got the DA now, and the both DAs at the funeral. We got Mr. Fields not being straightforward and telling us who the political ties is. We got allegations of a DA over the 08 case and the 2012 case that's possibly related and made statements in reference if he was, he would not remove himself from the case. So we got a $256 bond set amount. So clearly we can see a script here, you know, to the good old boy system. So being that I'm pretty versed in the good old boy system, I began to continue to do my homework. Sitting back, the next day, after we had the funeral, a couple of days later, you know, I said June 8th was the funeral date. June 10th, we took the 13-year-old off of life support, so we had to have a second funeral. So we had two funerals. The first funeral, we had five caskets. It was five family members buried at one time. I think it was pretty much the largest funeral for a family here. According to the statements from all the first responders, and the law enforcement, this is one of the worst accidents ever that they had ever saw, according to this tragedy. Unfortunately, we never made it to the scene, and I think it was God's will that we didn't make it there, because as the details begin to come out on how graphic this was, it's definitely something I don't think my family should have saw. So God didn't prevent it because we was too busy shuffling from the state troopers that brought the information to my father that night, and I'm kind of backtracking here. He had to get them to give them different heights and colors really to determine the victim in the car. It was a very horrific accident. This young man was driving a 2500 Dodge Super Duty truck. My mother was driving a 96 Grand Marquis. So at the speed he was going, it was clearly, which I coined, seven people slaughtered in slaughter. So I have a Facebook site with that title, the number 7 in Slaughter because I wanted to denote the level of damage that was done, how severe the injuries were to the victims. They were pretty much slaughtered by this young man in every sense of the word. Going forward with it, we find out all this information, and so we kind of in shock. But I'm doing my homework. I was staying up so many hours at night that blood vessels in my left eye popped. I was compelled to find out what was really going on with this case. As we went on, in initial proceeding in the case, we had no communication with the DA in the first two proceedings. When we entered the courtroom, the DA did not even look at us in the courtroom. He didn't have no communication whatsoever. So we had no dialogue on what was exactly going on other than having their proceeding. It wasn't until the third proceeding where my family protested, being understanding that this young man had political ties. We were going to the media, local media, to express our concerns, but the media did not want to address that his political ties and the nature of those ties. They never put any of these circumstances that surrounding the case in the media. Not about. We further found out after we received the police report, after it was compiled, the state trooper report, from the lady that was in front of my mother. She stated in the state trooper report that there was a heavy set. Well, she said she was driving in front of my mother. She said she was heading back home, and she was on the phone with one of her family members. Her husband was a passenger in her car. She stated that her husband yelled out, "He's in our lane," and she quickly took for the ditch because there is no meter, there was no shoulder on those highways, a two-lane highway. She pulled over to the ditch. She said that Mr. Gerald passed by her, and his eyes were bloodshot red, as big as saucers. She said that when he impacted my mother's car, the impact was so loud that she thought her car was hit.
Man.
She then said she got outside of her car, and she noticed that it was a heavyset black woman in the middle of the highway, and there was a black male at my mother's car. She said they made it there quickly. She don't know where they came from. Now, let me describe something to you all. This is a rural tract of highway. There are houses scattered. Maybe Mr. Mahabier, Brother Shorty, as we call him, he's a resident in this town. He lives exactly about a mile from where the accident happened off this highway. And he's dealing with a case himself with this. He's going to speak as well. But I want to give y'all understanding that it's a two-lane highway, and it's a very well-traveled highway that should be expanded. It's limited lighting on this highway. And on this particular area where the incident happened, there was two houses and a trailer there. There was two houses and a trailer right almost identically in front of the accident. Now, that black, heavyset black female and that black male that was at my mother's car lived at those houses. They were actually the eyewitnesses to the accident. They were outside when this all took place. Now, what the family found strange was no one ever took statements from these people, not even the state troopers, no one, even though the lady, the white female in front of my mother, stated that they were there. No one took statements from them. So that was another thing that we found to be odd. Now, according to the white female in front of my mother, she stated that her son, in the report, according to the state trooper, her son was farther up in another car in front of her. Mrs. Gerald had ran them off the road as well, but they refused to testify because they knew him. There was no testimony from them. And like I said, I want to readdress the 08 case on the same highway. There were similar incidents before he ran this lady off the road as well. There were incidents before that where people said that he had veered way before he got there into their lane and ran them off the road. So it was clearly that it was a MO with him. This was something that he was familiar in doing, considering that he was veer out of his lane and run people off the road. He did this in three incidents. Also, the third incident, we killed 7 people, which was 6 of my family members. Now, so we got all this information. We got, you know, we got a grandfather that's a senator. We got a senator involved with the case. So what I did with my father, I started to retract on things. So I got with my father because I was trying to remember, well, how Mr. Fields got involved with our family in the first place. So I asked my father, Reverend Gaines, Reverend John Gaines Sr. I said, well, how did he get in, how we get in contact with us anyway? Well, he said, well, our pastor, his pastor and mine contacted him and stated that a third party that worked for Mr. Fields contacted him and inquired about my family, for Mr. Fields, stating that, isn't that one of your church members? Well, Ms. Cleo wanted to get involved with the case. So he knew he couldn't contact us directly. He indirectly contacted us using a third party. And I want to emphasize that to you, to everybody that's listening. He indirectly contacted my family. By law, he could not contact us. So he indirectly contacted us to get involved with this case. So now as I'm adding all this information up, you know, and seeing that he's refusing to go into the media, they're talking about the civil case. It was told to us by residents out there that the state trooper came out to the case, came back out to the scene, and that drugs were found from residents in that area. Now, when we brought this back to the Cleo Fields, he was like, well, everything is not important to this case, you know. We have enough information for to convict him, and that is that. He made emphasis that with his partner, Rick Caballero, who I think he's Cuban or Colombian descent, Rick Caballero was pretty much the mouthpiece in all this, and speaking about all the cases he won, and it's basically it was money, 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 you know, how much money potentially there, and what could be come out of it. In this third conversation with Mr. Fields happened on July 2nd, I was ready for this conversation because I recorded this conversation, understanding that under the state of Louisiana is a one-party recording state. As long as I was part of the conversation, I could record it. So I have an hour and 42-minute conversation of our last meeting with Mr. Fields and his partner. And if once this information comes out to the public, because I'm going to make it available to the public initially, because we're really trying to keep this man in jail now. So we're trying to prioritize and keep one thing, but I want you guys to know out here in the public what's all happening. A lot of this information hasn't been in the media, but I'm sharing this on this show and shows like this because y'all are not local media. This was expressed in the local media, and it wasn't afforded to be afforded to the public for whatever reasons, the powers that be. But I know this will be aired on this show, so that's why I'm affording it here. It's been told to the media, but they didn't play it. They desensitized the stories locally, and they altered what we say in pretty much every aspect. The eyewitnesses, it all didn't concern them. The political ties was only mentioned after the first protest we had, and that was at the third proceeding where we had no communication with the DA in the case. That's where we begin to get a dialogue, where we made signs that stated no more political ties, no more political favors. We want justice. And those signs, the advocate locally, was the first time they mentioned of Mr. Gerald's grandfather, but they only mentioned him as a former senator. It was briefly. So as all this information comes out to us, we're going into the initial proceedings. The DA is trying to take himself out the case now. He's basically not trying to prosecute the case, so he's basically trying to take yourself out the equation and prosecute it. Because of all the information we compiled, he see we're persistent with our stance for justice. So what he does is lax in his prosecution. I brought to him, to the DA myself, the eyewitnesses. He said, give me their names and let me contact them. He has investigators, the state troopers, and nobody took information. This was continuously brought up in the media. It wasn't until I did shows like Tony Brown, Brother Brown, Raiden Alexander, Eyes Wide Open, Brother Cujo Livingston in Lafayette, these black journalists, Sister Antoinette Harrell in New Orleans, they were the ones really telling our story. We couldn't get the total story out. It was enough for the public to really understand that something was wrong, but they wasn't given all the facts surrounding this case. So the public was still scratching their head to understand why these things were happening. And clearly the family had evidence to support why. It just wasn't given to the public. So as we go on through the initial proceedings, after the jury proceedings, we protest. We create a dialogue with the DA. He tried to, appease us, but he was limited in volunteer information on what was happening in the case, and he limited the information on that. So I began to do research on my own. We came up let me add this as well. Throughout this whole ordeal, this young man had a not guilty plea. So while we scrambling to bury our family and all that, he's maintaining his innocence, which is typical in cases and like this. But being that the severity of it, we would have thought he was spared the family the anguish of taking us through this and trying to maintain an innocent plea. It was clearly that the defense attorney, Tommy D'Amico, was looking for technicalities to get him off. First, he asked for discovery on the black box. Now, the black box, which cars have, they claimed that the black box was damaged, and they could not determine what information off of that box, according to the investigators from the DA's office and the expert witness of the defense attorney. However, let me tell you something. Another thing, the cars were taken to a salvage yard in Slaughter, Louisiana. And when we finally got a chance to review the car, the owner of the salvage yard, to me, he knew the family. Now, mind you, the incident happened on May 30th of 2012. The salvage yard had the car to the 20th of June. On the 20th of June or a little before, the state troopers, after they investigate the vehicle, released the car. Our current counselor, Mr. Fields, did not send anybody out to review this car. According to information I received from his firm in the form of emails, when the family picked the car up on the 20th after the state trooper released it, Mr. Fields' office stated to tell the defense to not touch the car until they review it. Now, they had 3 weeks to review this car. They never looked at the car. So we found that strange as well. Also, I want to emphasize that Mr. Gerald, before he was released on a $256,000 property bond, he also, his blood was not taking when he made it to the hospital until 2.5 hours after the incident. Now, 2.5 hours after the incident, they took blood to determine Mr. Gerald's BAC, blood alcohol content. Now, mind you, I want y'all to emphasize this to y'all, that blood alcohol level goes down 0.5% every hour. So his blood alcohol level had went down 0.15% in 2.5 hours, according to the statistics by law on blood alcohol level. So it was clearly injustice in even him taking his blood. He was almost 2 times the limit. He blew a 0.15. Even after them taking blood 2.5 hours, that was almost 2 times of the legal limit, despite them taking it 2.5 hours later. I just want to emphasize that to everybody, to how they have been scripting this from every angle they possibly could. But one thing they didn't expect was us to continue to pursue this and investigate the case as well. So what I began to do is obtain all his prior arrest information. I started to dig in deeply into his case because of the news media about his prior arrest. And I started to find this information based on the fact that these were public records. So I started at the DA's office on his 08 case that the same DA handled. This Mr. Sam DeCoola stated to me when I made it to his office that he had, in fact, destroyed his 2008 records. I had a former paralegal with me, and we both found it strange that he would destroy it. He then stated to me he did not have to keep those records but for 3 years, and he destroyed those records. So I was instructed by the former paralegal that was with me that let's go to the clerk of court's office and obtain their copy. Well, we retained the copy from the clerk of court's office. We began to read the information on the prior 08 arrest. That's when I began to get the information that I disclosed with you about the incident. What I found strange in there is that, according to the DA, when it was brought to his attention by the media, well, why was his charges reduced in the 08 incident, and Mr. Gerald was in charge for DWI? The DA clearly stated that he could not determine if the 04 arrest was a conviction. However, the 04 arrest was what they call a subsequent DWI. Now, being that Mr. Gerald was afforded a diversion program, that still showed up on his record. As I found in the 08 records I got from the clerk of court's office, when the state trooper pulled his arrest record up from the 08 incident, the 04 incident popped up. So the DA had information for the 08 case. But yet he negated to enforce that. He basically stated that he couldn't determine that. Now, being it was a subsequent, being if he was arrested in 5 years again on the same offense, that offense should have been used against him because it was a subsequent DWI. And he had to plead guilty to go through the diversion program to accept that. Now, also, in Louisiana, we have what they call the implied consent law that existed back then as well, all the way up until now. Under the implied consent, you cannot refuse a breathalyzer in the state of Louisiana and other states that have implied consent laws. Now, what I found out later on is how the implied consent works, being that criminals, offenders have Miranda rights and have the rights to remain silent. The law for refusal on people refusing is as follows. When you refuse, and by the implied consent law, it's the administrative action that is in place on you to take your driver's license. So it is administrative injunction applied. When you come to the courts, you refuse, they're supposed to automatically take your license. We have no proof for indication that Mr. Gerald's license was taken in none of these incidents, in none of them. So clearly there was injustice in these cases, and Mr. Gerald, as we stated and been voicing our opinion on, that the legal system in the state is just as liable as Mr. Gerald for the death of our family because they continually enabled him to be on the highway, even though there's more dynamics with the political ties with the grandfather. Believing our position now, we're Mr. Fields, and we're looking at what way we're going to pursue that because of the political ties and the corruption in this state, is that Mr. Fields did not act ethically in the standards of an attorney in withholding information on the family. Also, what made us look at Mr. Fields and was the final straw is a few days after the funeral, and mind y'all, this is so many different areas into this case. It's very, very complex. Mr. Fields, in allowing the media into our funeral, a few days after the funeral, we was notified, my brother was notified from one of his friends that they had, in fact, seen pictures of our family funeral. And he said, well, I seen the funeral, the pictures y'all have of y'all funeral for sale. My brother then stated, what pictures of our funeral? We don't have no pictures for sale. He said, well, they in the advocate's website for sale. So my brother informed me and my father and them, we looked in the advocate, and there, in fact, in the advocate's website, were pictures of my family's funeral. Five caskets, picture of me and my cousin on the podium, pictures of my father holding a photo of my mother and the obituary, pictures individually for sale for $10 to $200 a piece, and for frames for $75. When you look at the pictures initially when they were on the site, and I think those pictures are still on their site, the difference between them now and then is they had a buy now button on them. Buy now.
Now this, and let's also tell the listening audience this type of action or this injustice is going on rampant in Louisiana. It's and not to take away from this case because this is horrible, it's horrific, the things, and I want to remind everyone that Cleo Fields is a black man.
That's right. He is a black citizen.
I want people to know that
Matter of fact, I went to school with his brother. His brother is he's a federal judge. So this family is, you know, in the political arena, and he's a federal judge. And like I said, I went to school with his brother, Wilson Field. And the thing of it is with that, when he got involved, I took the position because I am the spokesperson for the family. I have done extensive research in this case. I have investigated and done the public relations in this case pretty much in its entirety.
He's also a former candidate that ran for governor of the state of Louisiana also.
Exactly. He is that. That's exactly. So he is connected through the political arena of the state. And as I stated before, that concerned me because of this young man's grandfather being a senator as well. As I started to build my case with our concerns about the ethics of Mr. Fields in regards to his representation of our family, I began to build information to determine was Mr. Fields going to continue to be our council representative, and that had to change. So what we did was when I went to speak to him, and like I said, I have a recorded copy of the conversation of our last meetings with Mr. Fields and his fathers, and I'm not scared to say that, that I also addressed the issue of the advocate. And it was stated to us, as I say, I have recorded conversations, that they had every right to be there because they was allowed in. Now, what it was is Mr. Fields took advantage of our family and making it an event and allowed them in. And that was one thing, because we clearly looked at it, okay, you allowed them in, they came in, they put stories out with these photos, but now they're each individually selling these photos. Where is the law stand? And I asked him that question when in my recording. I said, well, is this legal? He said, well, you know, they got copyrights. He kind of beat around the question. They got copyrights because they was allowed in. But and I didn't even state that he allowed them in. I just let him continue on. And the thing of it is, I told him it was distasteful. He talked to the senior editor, whose name was Carl Redman. And he said, I talked to Carl, and I told him the picture was distasteful to take the pictures out. And I said, distasteful, the damage has been done. Was that legal? These pictures was for sale. So his partner jumped in and said, well, I may be wrong for saying this, but maybe it was a good thing. And I say, for sale? And I got all this recording. He said, yeah, well, look at the innocence of the five-year-old. Look at, I'm like, for sale? I say, well, no, they shouldn't have it for sale. And the thing of it is, he stated himself on the tape. Well, yeah, because it make it look like that y'all selling them. And I say, exactly. I say, that's it. The public helped us and bury our family, and now the integrity of our name, as well as our civil rights violation. We want to know the legal rights. Is this legal? Well, Mr. Fields stated that it was legal based on, because they had their right, and to take the pictures out. And
but
he stated on there, say again?
Was, in fact, it was not legal if the family didn't give direct consent for those pictures to be sold. It's not legal.
Well, that's what I was told. I have a recording of that I was told. Now, it's going to get interesting as we go farther with it, because like I said, I've been out of work almost 2 months. I'm on family medical leave. I'm dealing with stress. I'm going through a lot of changes because I have a small one-year-old. Now, mind you, we have a strong faith in God, and God has been keeping me. He will keep me. But, I mean, this has really taken a toll on my family, and, you know, we feel the effects of it. So bear with me as I go through this with y'all because it's so much. You know, I haven't even completed because there are other parties that are involved with it. This case has so many different areas to corruption that, you know, I'm going to write a book about it. You know, I have to. Now, going forward with it, we asking him these questions. So after I get to tell him that we don't give a damn about money, after they talking about a potential third-party insurance policy, and after I get to tell him we don't care about money, we want to know why this young white male was afforded the opportunity to get out on a $256,000 property bond, you know, within hours, and no communication with the DA, and why these pictures were sold, and you know, we don't care. I say, and matter of fact, I made mention to him, not mentioning who this young man's grandfather was. I say, why we had to come to you, telling you who his ties were. You told us he had political ties. Then when we tell you who the ties were, you don't even want to discuss them. I say, what's wrong with that picture? I say, furthermore, we are even uncomfortable with even going further with you in this case. I say, because of the conflict of interest and the ties. I mean, you know, we understand this grandfather had will's a lot of power. And I said, I said, and we can see this happening in Clinton. And I say, you know, I lived outside of this country, and I've seen America from outside looking in, and it's had a pretty picture. And I told him, I'm very diverse. But the thing of it is, we know, I told him, he knows as well as I know that Louisiana is one of the most racist states in this country. And I said, and I didn't intend to play the race card in this case until I was going to let the race card play itself in this case based on the facts. Because what I tried to not to do, like we have a tendency to do, is to go out and act in the media on emotion. So based on all information that I provided to the media, it was based on everything that I compiled based on the facts of law, whether it be case law or facts surrounding the case. And a lot of the information the media didn't want to talk about. I guess I was talking too much. So the next day, after we left the office, my father and brother was unsure of this thing with Cleo Field. My brother contacted him, and Mr. Field said after that conversation he was going to remove himself. However, what he done was my sister had her 15-year-old son. I'm going to say her 15-year-old son, alleged father, Mr. Field kept him in his firm to pursue the case. Now, he had every right to be there in the case, but I took it as though Mr. Fields broke my family up because this young man had no dealings with his son, if it was, in fact, his son, because he was not on the birth certificate. We accepted him as the father of the son because we heard that he was. And the thing of it is, I think Mr. Fields took advantage of that to be still a part of the case for whatever financial gain that he could gain in this case. Mr. Fields also filed our civil case in the heart where this young man was from. He did not bring it to Baton Rouge. He filed it in St. Helena, where this young man is from, and there's strong political ties on. Now, I'm a law enforcement. There were rumors, allegations that in this particular town, this young man was getting pulled over every weekend, and this was from former law enforcement in that area, that he got pulled over every weekend, but they would get a call and they would have to let him go. Now, this was from a former law enforcement official that stated that, the allegations that he was getting pulled over. So we realized that he was afforded a lot of favoritism to go through the court proceedings this many times and had the potential to kill so many times and wasn't being afforded this. The family's position now was Mr. Fields, in fact, sent to our family. Having to find out that we didn't contact him, he indirectly contacted my family and the way he was pursuing the case. I then recorded that. We severed ties with Mr. Fields. We sent him a notice, and we have retained new counsel and Ms. Jill Kraft in the case. Because of the political ties and what Mr. Fields put us to, my family has been traumatized, and we are very leery of all legal representatives in the state, particularly. I'm talking to nominated people for a nominated person, and Kenneth Pollet, who's been nominated for the Eastern District U.S. Attorney General's office by President Barack Obama, and the senator who you said Mr. Fields endorsed, Mary Landry, for the Eastern District. And he understands the ramifications of this. He advised us to get outside of the state. That has been a very hard fact, considering we're dealing with this. And because it's a continuous fee, what happens is poor people is why blacks are so much locked up, and I realize this being law enforcement myself. Poor people are people that are not in political power or have influence over the justice system are always going to come out last in the court proceedings. As you can see, in the Trayvon Martin family case, when the closing arguments happened and the defense attorney stated that this case is not about race, I posed the question that was, you know, who was he speaking for when he made that statement? And it clearly he was speaking for the state because he's a state attorney. It's clearly evident that Trayvon's mother and father figured it was about race, but yet the prosecutor in the case injected that it was not about race, and he was clearly not representing the family when he made that statement. And that's my point exactly. It's clearly happening too many times that the judicial proceeding is where our worst travesty is as far as incarceration in this country, and particularly the state of Louisiana. Louisiana has the highest incarceration rate in the world, and the majority of them are people of color, and particularly African-American. So in knowing that, people say, well, that's just because they commit more crimes. According to the FBI reports that you can pull them up on arrests by race, white people outnumber us in every area of arrest, including yep. crimes of violence, almost 2-1. Yet yep. blacks make up the larger portion of conviction, and that's because of the disparity in the judicial system based on political ties, influences, wealth, and race. So all those are forms of racism, whether it be discrimination, bias, or racial discrimination through the judicial system. All those factors are what influences decisions, and it's why that white people commit as many crimes as black, rape, you name it, drug abuse, you name it. And it's a big article on it that was did, I think CNN discussed it, about the Fed frisk laws in New York, why they were racial profiling blacks. And I think the CNN anchor stated that he was from a rich white neighborhood, and white people did as much crimes as that. And it's just that, you know, black people are targeted. We're poor. We live in the areas. You know, white people can afford attorneys in most cases. They know people that are influential. And how it works in Louisiana is for people to understand that these are families. You know, if you look at the parish that you're in and you see who in the system, the people that run the system are actually related. So the judges, the DAs, the sheriffs, the wardens in these small satellite camps, they are all family members that are tied in through marriage and blood that are pretty much influencing the decision. So I make this statement to everybody. I said that, when the Civil War was supposedly won, I say, what do you think happened to all the rich, semi-educated slave owners that did not want to free their slaves? I say they became judges. They took those clansmen took off those hoods and everything, and now they got on robes, and they got on uniforms, and they wear suits. And they're judges and they're legislators. And in the laws, there are what we call, I think it's a book out, and people should pick this up. It's called The New Jim Crow. Through the judicial system is how they're enslaving us. Right now, the prisons in Louisiana, prisoners are paid 2 and 4 cents an hour. And that's only because it wouldn't consider slavery. Now, being a part of this and understanding the dynamics of it, we got to understand that blacks are disenfranchised because we are mostly ignorant to the law. Being that I had a general knowledge, I have pursued this case and kept us in this case. Because had I not pursued it, this young man possibly would be home already or on his way home maybe in a couple of years. So this case is going to the Supreme Court, and I'm going to continue on to where the case – I'm going to get where we are now to take you further into this case because there are a lot of more dynamics to it, and it probably won't be able to be fully spoke on in – on the show, but I'm going to go further with it. So now we didn't protest it. We didn't found out the political ties. We're leery of our counsel because he indirectly contacted us, who was a former senator, who denied us the right to know that this young man's grandfather was a former senator as well, and not only a former senator, a convicted former senator that wields a great amount of power. So we see the evidence of why all these things that the public was aware of were like, well, how did he get to be arrested so many times for DWI and didn't get charged? Why is he still on the road? Well, it pretty much was afforded to him because he was white and he was privileged, you know? Now, had the roles been in reverse and I killed 7 white people, then I would not be in the position he would be right now, which I'll discuss going further. But these are what are the facts that we had, and now we're pursuing this case to the fullest extent of the law, based on the law and the facts surrounding the case. So as we go further, we're in protest in the case. We got the DA attention. The public is aware now through the signs that we have done that there is political ties and political favors, but there's not much mention in the media of who these ties and favors are. So we go in the case. further in. The young man comes up, and I he went up to, he went to the initial proceedings. He went to his arraignment. The state trooper came into the case. He testified. There was discovery, I mean. And what the DA, what the defense attorney was wanting discovery was the black box, I explained. Now, this black box was allegedly damaged, but we ain't got no money. We poor people. We can't hire an expert witness to get the black box. Now, I want people to understand this, too. In a criminal case, you are appointed attorney like a public defender in the case of a traffic ticket or any other thing. If you can't hire an attorney to represent you in a criminal matter, you're automatically appointed then in a district attorney or assistant district attorney. So, but the illusion is that this person represents the state. He really don't represent the victim, as I'm going to show you going forward. So now we got the DA not prosecute this case. Okay? We going forward with it. We get up and to the discovery. The defense attorney is requesting to hire an expert witness to review this black box that they said that the DA alleged was destroyed. And he was trying to determine, he wanted the records on the blood sample, the transactions of his blood work, to make sure that the nurse was certified to take his blood and all this. And so they're basically looking for loopholes and technicalities to get him off. They already set the stage to get him off with not interviewing the eyewitnesses. You know, they got everything set up. So I'm in the midst of all this. I'm seeing, you know, unfortunately, I'm one of the ones, you know, was able to go in and actually review and ask questions in regards to it. So going further, state trooper that arrested him got on the stand and he got to talking about it. It was deemed that everything was as was. You know, he also stated that Brett Gerald made it home before he did, and things of that nature. In his statements. So we go farther. That was debuffed. We're going on. We're leery of everybody now. Remind you, we in trauma. We traumatized pretty much. But thank God he kept us. He kept us with sound minds. We're loving each other. We're staying supportive. And we're pursuing the case. So I'm spearheading this for my family. I'm taking the general legal information and the legal knowledge that I have and applying it to new laws and understanding the full ramification of a criminal proceeding. So as I begin to dig into the laws, the first thing I come upon is our victims' rights. Victims have rights in the state of Louisiana and every other state. The scary part about it is as I dove into these rights, I realized the legislators wrote these rights to give you rights, but to give you limited remedy to enforce your rights. And I'll get into that further. So as we get into the rights, you have the right to be treated with dignity and respect. We didn't get that. You have the right to confer with the DA and be heard at any proceeding, post and pre-conviction. That didn't happen. Okay, you have the right to review the pre-sentence investigation report prior to sentencing. You have the right to have your attorney at charge confer on the criminal matter. So, in other words, a civil attorney can actually, we can have one confer with the judge and the defense attorney and the DA in a criminal matter. Now, this is where the problem lies at. In, say, we poor and black, and we get a civil attorney because we have the DA represent us in the criminal case. We get a civil attorney. They work in what they call a contingency. So whatever money's out there, that's what they're going after. Now, lawyers are high. So if a lawyer works on a contingency, it's going to be some kind of money for them to collect, for them to take the case. Now, when you get a lawyer, you know, my mother always told me, you get what you pay for. When you get a lawyer on a contingency fee, unless they are extremely compassionate and just love to help people, you know, they're going for the money. Okay? Now, the thing of it is, in this case, what I was able to do was compile all the background history. I afforded my civil attorney all his prior arrests. I got the transcripts and the proceedings. I did that, which that would have cost thousands of dollars. So, in other words, I enabled our civil attorney to be more informed instead of her doing it. Because if I go to the courthouse and get a transcript. It might cost me $200, but it's going to cost her $200 plus the time that she costs to get there. So lawyers are $200, $300, $400, $500 an hour. So you can just do the math on that. And a lot of lawyers just are not going to take a lot of time to really pursue something that they're not going to get paid for. I'm just, that's the way it is. So what happens is, because blacks are, in most cases, in the criminal district, poor, they cannot afford the legal representation, you know, to be afforded to get law, a balanced judicial system. So, you know, like other people. And that's not in every case, but just blacks are disproportionate in that measure. So going forward, I realize that this is the problem. Let me do this. Let me be the lawyer. I'm gonna go, and I encourage anybody that goes through a case, please get involved with your case. Do not allow the attorney to dictate to you, you know, what to do in the case or what he's gonna do. Research the laws and then compare what the attorney's gonna do. Because if you let somebody take over your case, with even because they're an attorney, that don't mean nothing. That don't mean they're gonna be right. So a lot of people case been messed up because. Allowing the legal counsel, you know, if you ain't paying for it, you know what I'm saying, you're going to get unlimited results. So fortunately, I was able to go in and do a lot of research to keep us, you know, so to speak, in the game. So as I pursued all this to get the background information, DA told me he destroyed it. You know, I get the information for the clerk, of course, realized that he could have been afforded the right to see it. So I look at the procedures to how the criminal process is in its entirety, and so and how it applied to us as victims. So as I review all this information, and like I say, it's comprehensive, detailed information. It's a lot of work, but I thank God He gave me the ability to do that. So I was able to go in and see where we was in the case, and just to understand based on law where we was going. So as I go in, then I realized that this DA and judges. I want everybody to understand that DAs and judges. Have such a level of immunity that they can commit a crime, and because the Supreme Court has made the laws to where you cannot sue them or they cannot be punished in their official capacity because they don't want them to be able to be afforded to be blackmailed to extorted. So the judges and DAs know they have this broad level of immunity, so a lot of them commit, you know, biased crimes. I mean, if they know somebody coming to the court, they swaying stuff. I mean, that's just ideas. You know what I'm saying? So, say again?
Unfortunately, that's going on all the time in a lot of the courtrooms, especially
that's
here in Louisiana, where they want to do, they suppress evidence, and they legally can suppress evidence, which is detrimental to a case.
Yeah, I'm going to tell you, it's a game. It's John Thompson versus Louisiana. I pulled up in reference to that because as I got to dove on ethics, you know, I'm trying to find out the ethics of attorney ethics, you know. So as I dove into it, and then I pulled up case law, John Thompson versus Louisiana. This man was convicted of murder and was sentenced to be death row. He was on death row for 14 years. I think it was a week or a day before his son was to graduate high school. His attorneys, and you can pull this up, John Thompson versus Louisiana, his attorneys sent a letter to him and told him to take a paperclip, prick his finger, and send him some blood. So he said he must have found something. Well, what they found out, the DA suppressed DNA evidence that would have exonerated him from the case. The case was brought back. He was released from death row. He sued the DA. For not giving that information, was awarded $14 million. The case went all the way to the Supreme Court. Supreme Court would not withhold the ruling of his. He was awarded by a jury $14 million. It went to the Supreme Court. Based on the law, they could not prosecute or sue him. And they wasn't, and nobody got sued on that. He just had to do 14 years. The DAs couldn't be prosecuted because of their level of immunity. And that's what they're doing. Based on law. So until we get together and really understand these laws and get together as a collective, see, they got us too busy watching, you know, the Lakers game, and, you know, they got us doing other things, and the real stuff we should be focusing on, that's what they take our mind off. So, you know, had I not been compelled to do this, I wouldn't be in the knowing of what's really going on, you know? So I thank God for that, you know, he was able to allow me to do this, and I want to make sure that everybody else is aware of how these laws work in this state and other states as well, because it's not the only state. That's how Trayvon Martin was able, Zimmerman was able to get off, based on loopholes in the laws. You know, his daddy was a judge. Now, see, had the Martin family did what I've done, and, you know, and I want to tell y'all something, this close relation to this case, to that case, because Mr. Benjamin Crump, like I said, I spoke to initially in this case. He was supposed to take our case, but that case took a turn, and you can see it's a landmark case in Florida with the Zimmerman trial, like this case will be to Louisiana, because it's going to the Supreme Court. I can assure you of that, unless they pull some good old boy stuff. But you can clearly see in that case as well, you know, that the laws are the same all over. They created laws. The Republicans created that stand your ground law. Louisiana have similar laws. The DA of Baton Rouge stated that, too. We got the same laws here. Yeah, I know it, too. You know, shoot the carjacker and all that. These are clearly laws to allow people loopholes to kill people and be able to get off. Not black. Because, see, if you're black and kill somebody, you can't afford a special law to work the loopholes, like Brett Sherrill's doing in this case. But if you pull and kill somebody, see, you're going to get a public defender, and they're going to give you double the time. So that's why so many blacks incarcerated, because of the loopholes in the laws, the people that's prosecuting them, quid pro quo politics, and cronyism.
Well,
that's
even if we can afford a lawyer here, they won't allow us to use the same law that they use. The law.
No, they won't. It's a double standard, Stuart. You're right. Unless you really connected, you're right. Yeah, and some people may get to pull through it, but they got to pull some real big strings. You know what I'm saying? But, I mean, like you say, based on law and facts, that's how it is. I mean, even if we do get a lawyer, we won't get the same standards as them, you know? So, you know, we get people in the media saying, he didn't mean to do that, you know, this and that, and I'm listening to all the comments, you know, and you can tell who's saying what, who's black and who's white, based on their opinion.
When
you know,
the shooter gets off and the thug gets prosecuted, that's how they are separated.
Exactly. Because they stereotype us like they did Trayvon Martin. Clearly, this is a young boy was coming from the store with a tea and Skittles, and this man killed him in cold blood, but just the jury heard what she said. You know, George, he was going by his first name, and they couldn't even connect to Trayvon as black male because in her eyes, he was a young black thug.
Well, we have cases coming up right now here in Louisiana. We have Mayor Leslie Thompson of Jonesboro, where the judge suppressed evidence, would not allow the DA could exonerate one of the gentlemen that's in one of the cases connected with the mayor, which showed that he was totally innocent, and because he was a DA and was ready to testify. The judge wouldn't allow the DA to testify. And DA had vital evidence that he was actually talking to the man, and because the judge said, no, you can't testify, then he had allowed people to come up and lie and all have conflicting stories. Not only that, a video was shown showing the man exonerating him, and the judge still said the man was guilty. So, I mean, it's so many things in Louisiana. You have another case with Miss Mary Neal, right, later down in Clinton, Louisiana. Yeah. And that case there where the judge railroaded this lady and her son on case that should have never gone to court. So
right.
Lee has a
history. Mr. Gaines was there the same day that we came down.
Yeah, I know Miss Connors. I know Miss Connors. Miss Connors knows. She knows the fans are taking it. Yeah, it's Julia Trent. And that's the same thing with Mr. Mojave that's on the phone. He had
right. That was Catherine Connor, right? That's right.
Yeah, Catherine Connor, right. Yeah. Mr. Mojave has a similar case that he's going to share, too, because he has a case in Baton Rouge that's been going on for 25 years where he was kidnapped by a police officer and beaten, and now he lives in Clinton area where he got about 20 acres of land. And in his case now, you got people that's been living next to him that are white that's been living there probably since slavery, you know, 300 or so years, and they use his track, his driveway, a tract of land to come on to their land, and they, you know, they disrespected. They throw beer cans and things like that. So he had something put through the court system 2 years ago, but the sheriff didn't there won't enforce it. So he's been
there
for 2 years.
Mr. Gaines, what I want you to do I want you to go ahead and conclude what you have to say, your case, and then we're going to let Mr. What's his name?
Mojave. Yeah. Yeah,
okay.
I'm sorry. Okay. Well, we had one on our case, and I'm gonna go forward because I think everybody got the general idea of what's happening with the case. So now I'm educating myself on my rights and laws or what the do's and don'ts that can happen through this court proceeding. We going on up to the sentencing date. The sentencing date was the trial, December 10th. Remember, he had a not guilty plea. Before the sentencing, I'm touching bases with the DAs because I was told to stay close to him, to pick him to what's going on with the case, and don't tell him what I researched to kind of get a guide to what was going on because he limited information in telling us what's going on. It's like, sit down, black people, I got this, don't worry about it. You know, that's the attitude he had, you know. But I was very vocal through the media. Everything that I'm stating, I went into the media prior to and made mention and protested and stated what was going on. So we getting up to the sentencing, the trial date of December 10th, 2012. Before that, about 3 weeks before that, I decided to call him and ask him, was there any new motions filed by the defense? Because I didn't want to get caught off guard going into knowing something could possibly happen with all this stuff, information we found out. He told me that the defense attorney, in turn, was not going to, he was going to file a no contest plea. In the case. And, you know, as my research in the no contest, I understand that that'll affect us in our civil case, as well as him not admitting guilt. We will not be allowed to use the information from the criminal trial in there, where clearly there was so much evidence. I then stated to him that the family's position, that we did not want it to do a no contest plea, that we wanted this case to go to trial, and we wanted that to be made mentioned in court, and what was his position. He then stated, again, like he had always, to take himself out of the equation, it ain't on me, it's on the judge. I said, well, Mr. DeQuilla, you're the prosecuting DA. What is your position with giving information to the judge on our opinion and what we feel we want to happen in the courtroom? Well, I can't make them plead anything and this and that and that and this. And so we went back and forth. So I went to the media with it, Channel 2, WBRZ, and stated the family, you look at W2BRZ in Baton Rouge, the family said a plea deal in the work. That was back in November. So that was discussed in the media. He got in the media and said he was going to put us on the stand and all this, and it was on the judge and all this in the media. We then got up into the trial date, December 10th. Mr. Gerald changed his plea from not guilty to guilty. We was notified by his attorneys in order for him to change the plea. It was a plea deal here, so we already knew that. They had already went in and did a plea deal between the judge, the DA, and the defense attorney. We went on with it. I continued to review everything with this information, being that we figured a plea deal had been done, and I had mentioned it before the actual trial date that we thought a plea deal was being done. Now we're seeing it had to be one for him to change his plea, according to our legal representation. Are we going forward? The sentencing date was set for March 14th. As I got to review the sentencing guidelines and what our rights were, we had the right to review the pre-sentence investigation report before sentencing. Now, for those who don't know what the pre-sentence investigation report is in a criminal proceeding, the pre-sentence investigation report is a report compiled by probation and parole. It is the main document the judge used to determine a sentence. It's what you call legally aggravating and mitigating circumstances. These are anything good would be considered mitigating on behalf of Mr. Gerald to lessen his sentence. Anything aggravating would be bad circumstances such as prior arrest and things like that to be on his sentence. So I knew this report was critical and to review, being that we had the right to review it, to make sure that they had everything in there, understanding that our rights. So I requested this through the victim assistance coordinator, who is the liaison between the DA and the victims. I asked probation and parole. They both denied me, saying that nobody got to see it but the judge, the DA, and the defense attorney. I asked the DA. He told me the same thing. So I told our attorney, and, you know, she did whatever, you know, that she did legally or whatever, you know, with the case, because I think she talked to the DA chief or somebody about it. Now, our remedy for this was a call of writ of mandamus to compel them to do that. However, that didn't get filed. So we were back with, you know, people talking to people and trying to get things done. Brett Gerald was sentenced on March 14th. I gave a victim impact statement where I stated in open court, based on what I had reviewed on the scope of a victim impact statement, basically saying how the case, the incident affected me, our family, physically, mentally, and financially. And so I had kind of formed it. My sister wrote something, all the family. Everybody pretty much started off with forgiveness because we're all Christian people. When I got up and gave my statement, it was a verbal statement. I kind of knew what I wanted to say. So the judge asked me to state my name. I stated my name and my relationship to the victims. I then began my victim impact statement. I said, on May 30th, 2012, Brett Gerald killed my mother, sister, and all four of my sister's children and a family friend after attending church. I say, from the nature of the incident, going into the initial bond set amount, going into the initial proceedings where there was a lack of communication from the prosecution has traumatized my family. They got the attention of the DA, so he immediately stood up in open court and said, Your Honor, I don't normally object to victim impact statements, but I want to object because this statement has no relevance. This proceeding has no relevance to that accident. The judge looked at him in a weird way, like, fool, what are you doing? This is a victim impact statement. He did not sustain or object to Mr. Dequila's objection. He just then told me to proceed. I then looked at Mr. Dequila and said, Mr. Dequila, I don't know you, sir. This is not personal. But how can you tell me that these proceedings have no relevancy to the night of the incident? Had Mr. Gerald not killed my family, we would not be here, sir. And these proceedings have every relevance to the case. I then begin to explain who my mother was and my sister and who they were to our family and how it affected us. After I gave my impact statement, Mr. Gerald was sentenced to 70 years in jail. We went downstairs into the conference room, spoke to the DA. We asked the DA, I particularly asked him, so you're telling me, according to my law, you know, Brett Gerald would have had to serve, according to the law, being that he had vehicle homicide, being that it's a crime, it wasn't a crime of violence. Offenders that get sentenced to vehicle homicide, the minimum sentence is 3 years on each count. Now, being that Mr. Gerald had two enhanceable offenses, anytime you blow a 0.15 or above, that makes that offense enhanceable when you kill someone. Vehicle homicide. So instead of 3 years, it jumped to five. If you have a prior DWI conviction, that's an enhanceable offense. So it jumps from 3 years to five. So Mr. Gerald had two enhanceable offenses. He blew a 0.15 and he had a prior conviction, which he should have had more than one conviction to make it more enhanceable. But that's one of the two that was on the records. So Mr. Gerald was sentenced to 10 years on each count. The judge gave him 10 years on each count. But what I found out later, it was a split sentence. That means he only had to do 35 of those years before he was eligible for probation or parole. Now, when we got in the conference rooms, I particularly asked the DA, so you mean to tell me he has to do 35 years before he can get out of jail, not be eligible for probation or parole, but get out of jail? He said, yeah, he got to do 35 years before he can get out of jail. So we went out to the media, Channel 2 and 9. They both stated, I think it was March the 14th, that Brett Gerald will be a senior citizen before he get out of jail. That means he was doing 35 years. He'll be a senior citizen. However, after that same citizen, his defense attorney went to the advocate and stated to the advocate, which I read the next morning, that Brett Gerald would be out with 23 years in good time. So that was the plea deal. You know, they had, you know, I did not look at the fact that he was eligible for good time because vehicular homicide was not a crime of violence. They knew that. Now, mind you, when I was talking about those FBI statistics, vehicle homicide is a white man's crime. Most of your judges and your lawyers and your DAs, they all drink. They do not have laws on the books to enforce this, but because statistically, black males do not, it happens, but it's not it took the highest percentage as white males. So that's a lax sentence versus if crack cocaine, you know, if you smoke crack rock and you get caught with it, you get 30 years. So you're looking at, you killing yourself and then killing somebody else, on the other hand, is lax based on the percentiles of the arrest and who get convicted for those crimes. So I want to make that note out to him. So he got sentenced to 70 years. So the DA said he had to do 35. The Channel 2 and 9, Channel 9 in Baton Rouge said he'll be a senior citizen, but yet the defense attorney went to the media, to the advocate, and stated he'll be out in 23 years. Now, remind you, I work in the legal field, so as I talk to my people, Well, I come to find out he could be out in less than that, in 10 to 15, the way the judge wrote up everything, like you were saying about the cases up there. You know, it's how the judge interpreted. They leave loopholes for these defense attorneys that they're friends with, that are high power, and they leave loopholes so they can fight through it. So they discuss how they're going to do it. The judge come out, and it's all scripted. He'll give these deals, and then the DA will come in, or the defense attorney, and pick these up for certain people. So this is what's happening in our case. So clearly from that statement, from the media putting out what our perception was and what the defense attorney perception was two different perceptions. So I went, after the next morning when I read the advocate, I went to readdress their media. They did not want to recant what they put out. You know, they didn't even want to talk about it. Matter of fact, one journalist interviewed us on a representative's proposal for to give offenders an extra year good time out. She showed us the report and did an article on us like we was totally against them getting out. When I clearly stated her position that I worked in law enforcement, and I think that some of them should be afforded to get out early, but it should be based, it should be on a case-to-case basis. She didn't paint the picture like that. So I had offenders.
She made it look like y'all was being sympathetic toward him.
Yeah, she made it then, you know, and I deal with these guys every day. So they made it look like, you know, I was just, everybody should be in jail. So she took a twist on it. But anyway, going into it, so now it is, he's got 70 years. Now, God stepped in. People were watching. 7 days after he killed seven people, 7 days after he was sentenced, a case in Bastrop, Louisiana. The case is entitled Oliphant, O-L-I-P-H-A-N-T, versus Louisiana. A person hit and ran two pedestrians, killing one. He was sentenced to 25 years for one count. Now, I'm pretty sure he probably was black. He then, in turn, did appeal to the Third Circuit Court of Appeal for excessive sentence. The Third Circuit ruled that vehicle homicide was not a crime of violence and his sentence should exceed 15 years. So they remanded it back to the district court. The assistant DA took it to the Supreme Court. Now, this is very critical, and people need to understand this. 7 days after Brett Jarrett was sentenced in another case, the Supreme Court looked at the definition of vehicle homicide based on the legislators. And the only reason why vehicle homicide was not a crime of violence based on the legislators because of one word, intent, being that they're saying that the person didn't intently kill. Now, the description for vehicle crimes of violence states using force to kill. So the Supreme Court interpretation of it, and mind you, we have a black Supreme Court justice who was tried to be blocked, who champions civil rights now, in Burnett Johnson. The Supreme Court ruled that vehicle homicide is, in fact, a crime of violence, and that this man had to serve 85% of the 25 years, and they used the definition of vehicle homicide, stating that using the car, being that you did not intentionally kill some, intend to kill someone, you intentionally got drunk and killed someone, and that taking a car and killing someone using force is no different than loading a gun with a bullet, pointing it at somebody, pulling the trigger, and killing them. And that's fact. So right now in the state of Louisiana, the only state, I think the federal government don't have it as a crime of violence. Louisiana, as far as I know, is the only state that has vehicle homicide as a crime of violence. So that was landmark in our case. Because now Brett Jarrett had to do 85% of 70. So we got with our attorneys, so we saying Brett got to do 59 now. It backfired on him. Well, because of those ties again, less than 2 months after he was sentenced, mind you, all the notifications that we had been getting in these proceedings, I didn't mention this, because like I say, it's so much to this case. Every notice we got was sent out to us pretty much on a Friday for a Tuesday's hearing. So we get it on Friday. They'll send it out on Friday. We receive it on Saturday. We get to comment on it. It's just say it's a motion, a hearing. We have to call in that Monday before that Tuesday hearing to find out what's happening. Now, Brett Jarrett, they did that in all the proceedings to keep us off balance because they knew we were protesting. So they said, we're going to show them. We're going to send them notice late or send y'all notice at the last minute. Yes, sir. Yes, ma'am.
You got four more minutes.
Okay. So here it is, Mr. Gerald was rushed back into court in less than 2 months, and his sentence was reduced to 35 years. The judge stated in open court he did not intend for Brett Jarrell to spend the rest of his life in jail. The defense attorney stated to the media that Brett Jarrell was a valuable asset to his family and community as far as the reconsideration. So 2 days after Mother's Day, we was rushed back into court with a limited notice, and Mr. Jarrell's sentence was reduced to 35 years.
This was after he was already sentenced, and they came back and reduced the sentence?
And reduced it because of the ruling with the Supreme Court. And they kind of say the judge tried to keep it comparable, but he stayed in open court. He did not intend him to spend the rest of his time, his life in jail. But he didn't say what the law said. He said he didn't intend. So he made it personal. So the thing of it is, he got resentenced to 35 years. We was in an outrage. We finally got to review the pre-sentence investigation report that they denied us to review after a lot of protests and the things. And the 08 case, his 07 case, his 2004 case, his being fired from his job, none of that was in the report. So now we're looking at them adding this. The judge just added it to the report Monday, and now we're finna go review the report with the new information that they didn't put in. And now and he's appealing his sentence to the First Circuit Court for a reconsideration based on his excessive sentence and possibly can be out in 5 years.
Oh, my God.
Isn't that awful? Yes, indeed.
It just shows the hypocrisy, the evil, and no good injustice of the state of Louisiana sitting here in the seat of the United States and how evil it is when it comes to how the cards of the deck is shifted when it comes to black and white folks being sentenced.
That's right. Now look at the editorial. Look at today's editorial in the Advocate from the defense attorney, because he's mad because I'm opposing them. They've been found out. It's coming out. I got records on the DA and everything. He wrote an editorial in today's Advocate about the case. Y'all should read it in the Advocate today on page 8B in the Advocate in the editorial. His name is Tommy D'Amico.
Made me angry for this.
Read the editorial, y'all. He invoked my family's deceased name, saying he was outraged that we protest judicial racism and that we are attacking the judge and the DA when they were honorable in what they did and that the judicial system works. Read that article in today's Advocate by Tommy D'Amico in the opinion section of the editorial.
Honorable in what it's they outraged. Did in protecting a killer. That's
yeah.
What they
right. See, this case is going to go to the Supreme Court. They're trying to lessen it, and we know the ramifications of it because it's landmarks in a lot of areas. It's going to challenge the victims' rights laws. It's going to challenge the standard, the dram shop law with alcohol. It's going to challenge a lot of things for all the information we got. So they are trying to give rebuttal and put influence in the public.
So stay on the line because I want to hear. Say your name again, sir.
William Javier.
Okay, can
hear
I
me?
Just call you? Yeah, Javier is what you're saying?
Yes, Mojavier.
Okay,
Mojavier.
It's Mojavier.
Okay.
I'm from the Cayman Islands. Yeah, I've been in Louisiana 25 years. I've had a case here originally in 1988. I'm originally from New York. I went to school in New York from the Cayman Islands. At the age of 19, I came to Louisiana with a radio broadcasting scholarship with my cousin Guy Brody, a radio star from California.
Yeah, Guy Brody.
I had a promising rap career in New York. I grew up with all the main rappers, and I'm still well known from the 80s. And I came here, and I got another calling to rap here in the South. But during the time of the early 80s, around 1988, I was kidnapped by a Ku Klux Klan city police officer from Baton Rouge. This gentleman kidnapped me in the middle of the night from my home in front of everyone. He broke my Adam's apple. That's why my voice sounds the way it is. He broke my nose, 3 vertebrae in my neck, my lower back. He tried to kick my privacy off. I have a scar across my lower abdomen. I had to be stitched up. My guts hung out for years. I couldn't afford the surgery. I filed a lawsuit within 1 year. The lawyers that I hired were very corrupt. I was not educated on the facts of Louisiana. Growing up, I learned about the Klan through watching television, but here I am being beaten by a Klansman. He told me he was a Klansman, but in his conversation while in the police car, he took me to LSU from my home. He told me that there's going to be an effing continuance in court if I sue him. And for 25 years, they have continued my case in Baton Rouge. Even in 2005, I had moved my case to the local Fifth Circuit Federal Court. And even in that court, the parish attorney of Baton Rouge, James Leslie Hilburn, along with Mary Roper, along with the city attorney, Kim Brooks, and
Hold up. Did you say Mary Roper?
Mary Roper. Mm. Yes, the parish attorney of Baton Rouge.
Brian.
Has covered up my case for 25 years.
Wonder where her family ties are.
We already know who that is.
And yeah. Most of the judges, I have a list on my Facebook wall and on the internet.
What's your Facebook page? What's your Facebook page?
Who's my, I couldn't hear you.
What's your Facebook page, Brother Short?
Okay, my Facebook page would be William Mohabier, M-O-H-A-B-I-E-R, M like Mary, M-O-H-A-B-I-E-R, the third. That'd be Roman capital three, you know, Roman numeral three, William Mohabier the third. And from there you can follow Twitter, the internet, YouTube. I'm getting ready to do a documentary film on the whole incident, what is going on in Louisiana. Also, I've been put into a movie called Lawless America. You can look that up also. I was the only black man that was willing to go on a congressional testimony before Congress to testify. People will say it's corruption, but it's only Klan activity in its highest degree in the history of America. The Klan took off their robes. They became judges, police, captains, and preachers.
But they already that. But they
local just... Christian community will not stand up behind me. They're afraid to speak out. They're paid by these politicians, these judges. All of them are corrupt. The attorney, the majority, 90% of the attorneys in Louisiana are on the take. They work through programs like Legal Shield and different organizations that promise to help you, and all they do is take your money. A person cannot afford a lawyer. When you go to a lawyer here, they want $5,000 retainer fee. And they go through your money, and at the end they tell you, I can't help you. So poor people have no rights in America. The laws are broken, and I know for a fact, through the education that I have and the calling of God on my life, that we can sit here and talk right now and work it out, go to court. But there are some dangerous people out in our community now that are being victimized, that carry guns, that carry machine guns, and they're not going to take this any longer. The country is about to see a lot of murders and killings across the country now because the local justice system is completely corrupt. The police stations are completely corrupt. Nothing has changed from the 60s. The only difference we have right now is we have cars, we have technology, and we have cell phones. I have documented recordings recently in this case that Mr. Gaines and I had gotten together. The family was killed, murdered a mile away from my home, and right here where I live, the East Feliciana Parish Sheriff Department, Talmadge Bunch, and his department have continually harassed me and my family, threatened us, violated our civil rights over and over again. I spent $30,000 in court in 5 years, and no one's been arrested. What they do is they leave the criminals by my front gate to harass me, to keep me pinned down, and keep me pinned down financially, even by one of my attorneys, who I'm going to fire Monday morning, because he works with them, and they have a saying in law called systemic heel dragging. That means they continue to drag it out. That's what they do with black cases. Anybody that's a minority, they'll drag the case. And in the case of Mr. Gaines' family, I am going to become a witness for the government against Samuel DeQuella. He has personally called me, playing me like a common one of these local no-good preachers, like I'm some kind of preacher for hire, called me on a Saturday morning 4 years ago and tell me, and I know he was drunk, 6 o'clock in the morning, crying on the phone, talking about, I'm going to take care of everything. I'm going to do it. I'm going to do this. I'm going to do that. I'm going to get the criminals. When I put money on the table and hired some lawyers, now he wants to call me and tell me I need to stop complaining. So I told, and I need to shut up. So I told Mr. DeQuella over the phone. I said, Mr. DeQuella, and this was in 2000, I believe it was 2008. I told Mr. DeQuella, I said, Mr. DeQuella, there is a God in heaven. People don't believe in the Almighty God and the justice and the judge of all of us. You don't have to believe me. But in time, you will be exposed, Mr. DeQuella. And lo and behold, when the Gaines family got killed, 1 mile from my home, after $30,000, there he was being exposed on national TV for being a big, fat liar. He's a liar. He's a criminal. When I go to the town hall meetings, he gets up and leaves because he knows that I know his little game. All of these people are doing in this country now, and I am not a racist person. I'm not prejudiced. I have a lot of white friends. But the majority of the white community are stealing federal grant money every chance they get. They're building houses, their own communities. They're hiring lawyers to keep people like Mr. Gaines and myself quiet and silent. But thank God for technology, because I've been quiet long enough. There are several people in this state right now who are scared very much so, because don't forget, in Mississippi during the time of that age when the Klan had run over Mississippi, it took the FBI, the CIA, and the President of the United States to come in and arrest certain people. And that's all, that's what it's going to take. And I have enough evidence on every last one of them, because I learned to pull out my cell phone. I learned to pull out my camera. I learned to record my phone conversation. I learned that when a police harass somebody else, I pull out my camera. The black community needs to come together. I've watched too many children get killed and gunned down, and they say it's black-on-black crime. No, it's a policeman riding in the middle of the night picking up our children, our young men and women, and leaving their bodies in these ditches and blaming it on a drug war. There's no drug war in America, okay? Because as far as I'm concerned, drugs are legal because they use drugs. I've been told by several people in the community that Samuel DeQuella and some of the people down there that run Feliciana Parish actually are on drugs. That's what's wrong with them. They're trying to judge people and trying to judge the community and trying to lock up every black American that they can with these laws.
But they're not going to make it mandatory that they take drug tests, though.
It is not, but it should be. It should be. Because, number one, anyone that has a public office, the books, see what happened recently in the past 20 years when the Internet came, you know, into full effect, I would say, and everything, DVD and CD and all this other stuff, Blu-ray, like Mr. Gaines said earlier, they've taken our attention off of reality. The reality is education. My
That's
wife
right.
and I had a meeting tonight, and we discussed it, and she wanted me to mention to y'all one fact that in this country right now, young black people are getting grants and loans to go to school to get an education. But when they graduate, they're not even allowed a job.
That's right.
When our young people go to the army, black or white or whatever, if you're well known and you get out the army, you get a job. But if you're black, you have to go work for McDonald's. You have to go work for Burger King. The whole country, if people would open up their eyes and look around, The majority of the white communities live in big homes and drive big trucks and have a large bank account. I was told by a friend of mine who was a Caucasian minister, he said when his loan of $100,000 he couldn't pay on his house, his bank officer pulled him in the office and gave him an application and said, fill out this form. You don't have to pay the money back. I've known black people that lived in their home for over 50 years. They get a letter in the mail, and at that given time of their life, they're old and they're on Social Security, their loan to their home has been sold to another company. Now their note for their home is no longer $900, it's $1,800. And watch this. The money that they owe is the interest on the loan. So when they try to go get these lawyers here, right here in Louisiana, it goes on every day. You can't afford that lawyer because that lawyer is friends with that financial organization. There is such a criminal hysteria, I couldn't say the word, atmosphere right now in the white community because I preach to them. I tell them, I said, look, you can't go around doing people wrong. What has happened to the Gaines family here in Louisiana and what has happened to me, it happened. But I'm going to make sure that everyone across this country and everyone across the world, because if our country can go to war and kill people, blow up buildings, destroy communities, and murder children, then come back here and why we don't have any rights. Why don't black American people have rights anymore? Why is the state of Louisiana in such a state that it's in? It's the lowest in poverty. It's the lowest in education. Yep. There are more people here with AIDS than anybody, okay? The most criminal preachers have been caught doing criminal acts here in this state. This is the only state that I know about that imprisoned a governor. There have been others, but I believe it's the first state. And one thing I'll say about Governor Edwards, he did what he did, but he apologized when he did his time. There are people out here right now working as mayors, working as chiefs of police, working as deputy sheriff, judges.
EAs.
They are not doing their job properly.
Not at all.
The lawyers are very corrupt. I had a lawyer take at least $10,000 from me and gave me two pieces of paper and told me today I'm not getting nothing after I come out of federal court. And I noticed his wife just got a brand new car. She's been paid off. Okay? Well, I took a picture of that car. Now I'm going to run the VIN number and look at the purchase date. See, what's going on here with Mr. Gaines and with myself, I promise you, look forward to see me in the future. Because I told someone the other day, I went to a town hall meeting. I said, you know what? All of you better be careful that I don't become the governor of Louisiana. Because I'm going to fire a bunch of people and put a lot of people to work. That's the attitude we have to have as leaders. That's what we need to do. We need to find out the laws that they have on the books. We need to go through our neighborhoods and our communities. We need to pull the people out of their homes. It's all right to have a block party, but let's have a law party. Tell them what
that's
the
right.
law is.
Wait,
the
you know, one
place...
of the...
Okay.
Not to cut you off, but one of the things
no,
that we got to start doing as a people, if I can interject, this is very important.
Yes,
we
sir.
Got to realize, and I think our main problem is we don't realize who we're dealing with.
Exactly.
We don't realize that they were never, in my analogy, and if you look at the history, there will never be justice when it comes to black and white, total justice. You got some high cases. But we have to, as a people, start coming together with our own and start doing something so that we can start creating these laws. You see, if we take over these areas that we're majorities in, we can change laws. We can make an effect. But what we do, we're too busy trying to get along and don't want to be labeled as a race.
That's right.
As this and as that, and while we don't want to be labeled because they take in turn, oh, you're playing the race card, I don't care what you want to call it, the hell with the race card, it is
right.
what it is. And I
right.
want thing is for my people to get up off of it because we want to be fair. I don't even worry about fair anymore. Because you guys have never been fair when it comes to us, so it's time for us to be able to come out of this hole that you put us in, and the only way we can do that is we have to come together as a people and start doing something for self and stop hating on each other like
that's
we
right.
always have been doing in the past. If we don't stop hating on each other and start supporting each other, we're going to be in trouble.
That's it.
Mr. Javier, Mr. Javier.
Yes.
Look, we want to get you on our local radio show. We got Mr. Gaines coming on tomorrow. We need to set up a date with you for you to come on our show. Okay?
Yes. Yes, ma'am.
You want me to do that? Because you guys.
No, and no problem. Here, no problem.
My head is so swollen right now because both of y'all have just blown my mind. Okay? With some stuff. I'm like, I cannot believe this actually happened. But people don't
right. In this day and time.
Right.
You know, it's what we have to understand, and I think, like Salida's saying, is, and I think the main part is that not that we don't believe it, is that
yeah.
we've been knowing it, but now we're talking to some people that it's happening.
Actually talking to people that it actually happened to.
And the main part is that some of our people are so naive, and y'all, you shouldn't be like that. And when we say, we have to understand that I hear a lot of people, and we try to use a lot of people throw at me, but I'm a Christian, and I think we should be with everybody. You know what? That's why we're in the point we're in now, because you take that mentality that you got to get along with everybody. Where if that's the case,
no,
why don't
that's
the white,
not what the word says. You don't have to get along. You,
why
the word of God has been twisted by some of these corrupt
you.
Preachers. Yes, sir.
Yeah, you know, we have to
corrupt.
Learn for ourselves. Lions don't take care of tigers. So
no,
we
right.
got to start doing for ourselves and start looking out for our own community, because if
that's
we
right.
don't, we're going to perish.
Well,
yes,
that's what's happening now. That's what's happening now, because they are defining. And see, the key thing in all that is, the key thing is, I heard a speaker years ago speak when I was living in Europe. He said, what black people has lost is the power to define. See, everybody else define everything for us. We, you know, and you know, remember Adam in the garden? Adam named the tree and the bird because he was a god like his father. He was created in his father's image. He was a god in the garden. So what made him a god is the power he had to define things. He said, that's a bird and that's a tree. So he named those. So we can define things like during the civil rights and even with the Trayvon Martin case today. When you look at TV, look at the people who define the things for us. Well, what the black people are saying is, you got their people defining us, even during the civil rights. I mean, when they was murdering us and raping our women and killing our children, you know what I'm saying? We didn't want to be a part of that. We didn't want no segregation. We wanted freedom. But they got on TV and say what we wanted because they knew they needed us as a workforce. So, like I said, to all those rich, semi-educated slave owners, they took the position of the high road because they had the money and power, so they became judges and their organizations, and now they like David Duke. They got suits on. You see what I'm saying? And they study us. They study us. I mean, they study our anatomy. They study us from the chemicals, compounds we made of, and they use things in society to manipulate us, like drugs. Because, see, a lot of people don't understand who they are genetically. I'm talking about genetically in this thing. I'm talking about the keys to melanin, the chemical that makes you black. It's deeper than the pigment. See, that's a chemical. You know what I tell people? I say, you know that keloid you see people get in their ear? I said, it is based on, if you knowledge yourself, ain't that my name John Gaines and I'm from Baton Rouge. Knowledge yourself is now that I am a highly melanated being, that my chemical melanin is in the universe. It has black hole properties. It absorbs all forms of energy. So when I go in the sun and I darken, my body stores that like cells, melanocytes. Melanocytes are cells that store energy from the sun. So that's why we darken. That's our connection to nature, which is God, through our chemicals in our skin. I tell people, I say, you know what color chicken egg really is? People in the city say, what? It's white? I say, no, that's a processed egg. I say, a chicken egg is brown. It's melanated. Everything in the universe is melanated to be normal. Remember that.
Hey, you guys. We're down to 90 seconds. Oh, my God, this was so fulfilling. I want to thank you guys so much. Tomorrow, you guys,
yes.
I'm listening to Mr. Gaines again. Tomorrow at, 10 o'clock on 1110 AM, KTTP.com. And if you can get us on the local, it's 1110 AM, KTTP. We cannot wait to get Mr. Mahavir on our show.
that's KTTP 1110am.com?
Yes.
Okay.
So I want to say thank you, guys. I'm definitely going to get back in contact with you. Talk to you tomorrow, Mr. Gaines. You guys, love you. We got so much work to do. I want to say again,
yes,
I'm
do.
So well.
Thank you all so much for having us on.
Like, definitely thank you, brothers, for coming out and standing strong.
Yes,
thank y'all.
Yes.
God bless y'all.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay, you guys, this has been Say Your Piece Radio Network. We shall return. This is Alita and Mr. Brian Coleman. Good night.